Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, as the economic situation worsens in the United States and economic anxiety mounts, at least two camps have John McCain's ear, the Phil Gramm camp, Gramm who says we're a country of whiners and a mental recession. He and McCain are very close, and Gramm has often been mentioned as a likely Treasury secretary to McCain. But another camp is emerging. An influential new book by two young Republicans is calling for something that may sound like an oxymoron, a conservative welfare state. The book is called Grand New Party, and I recently asked McCain's top economics advisor, Douglas Holtz-Aiken, if he's read it.
Have you read the book by two young Republicans called Grand New Party?
I have not read the book. I've been on the campaign, and I don't read anymore, but I hear it's great.
They hear it's great, and it's Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. It's by Ross Douthat and Raihan Salam. Salam is a former assistant to New York Times columnist David Brooks. They write for The Atlantic, and they join me now. Thanks for coming on with us today. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having us, Brian.
Thanks for having us.
Now, I'll get to John McCain's top economic advisor and more of his reaction to your book in a minute, at least the ideas that I threw at him without him having read it. But you write that rather than abolish the welfare state, which Republican rhetoric usually calls for, conservatives should reform the welfare state so that it serves the interest of the working class rather than the affluent. Could there really be such a thing as a conservative welfare state?
Well, I think that there have been components of the welfare state that have always been conservative. I think that, you know, when you look at the origins of the welfare state with, you know, Bismarck in Germany, it was the idea of helping to preserve...
To go back a little ways in time.
Yeah, to go back very, very far back in time. It was the idea of trying to kind of preserve a level of stability in society by, you know, demonstrating to the working class that they have a stake in economic growth and they have a stake in civic peace. So I think that, you know, there's a dimension to which the welfare state has always been conservative. Would you agree, Ross?
Yeah, well, and I think... I'd argue a little bit with the notion that Republicans have always been calling to abolish the welfare state. I think one of the arguments that we make in our book is that if you look at conservative successes over the past 25 years, there's always been that abolish the welfare state strain in conservatism, exemplified by conservative activist Grover Norquist's famous and oft-repeated line that we want to shrink the government to the point where we can drown it in a bathtub.
Right.
But if you look at, you know, if you look, for instance, you know, Ronald Reagan's famous inaugural speech where he says, you know, government is not the solution, government's the problem. If you actually look at the entire paragraph that that speech is embedded in, first he says, in the present crisis, government isn't the solution, government is the problem. And then he goes on to say, let me be clear, it's not my intention to abolish government, and here I'm paraphrasing, if you'll forgive me a little bit. It's to make it stand at your side rather than ride at your back, work with us rather than against us. And I think that if you look at the most successful conservative reforms of the past 25 years, from whether it's, you know, deregulation and changes to the tax code in the 80s, or whether it's welfare reform in the 1990s, you know, the welfare system, for instance, wasn't abolished by the wildly successful 1994 welfare reform. It was changed so it promoted opportunity rather than dependency, move people into the mainstream workforce, and so on. So we think that that's a viable conservative tradition, and one that we're trying to promote in the book.
That Reagan quote, when he talked about the present crisis in 1980, that was stagflation. Do you think we're in a very parallel crisis today?
Raihan, you want to?
I think that we are in a crisis that's similar in some ways, but actually a lot thornier in others. I think that, you know, the crisis that Reagan was dealing with was a crisis of managed capitalism that had built up over a long period of time of excessive intervention, but also wage and price controls, things that we now consider to be so, you know, blindingly stupid that no one in their right mind would ever propose today, or you know, so we hope. But I think that the problems that we're facing now are really a lot more complex. They're a lot more diffuse. And there are things where, you know, it's very complicated to describe exactly what the government's role ought to be to get us out of the crisis. There are things that are just not very susceptible to old-style solutions. So I think that it demands a level of pragmatism and flexibility and creativity. And I think that's something that, you know, people fear is in short supply on both the Republican and the Democratic sides.
That quote from your book that I mentioned, reform the welfare state so it serves the interests of the working class rather than the affluent, What do you have in mind when you say it serves the interests of the affluent? Corporate welfare or something else?
Corporate welfare is a big part of it, but also when you look at the tax code and the way that, for example, we use the tax code to subsidize health care, it overwhelmingly benefits people who are middle class or wealthy because, you know, it happens in the form of tax subsidies. Now, tax subsidies, you know, we all like our tax breaks, we all like our mortgage, you know, tax credit, et cetera. But the thing is that they're not always the most coherent way of getting the results that we want. What's the result we want through the mortgage tax credit, for example? We want to be sure that, you know, people are in homes. We want to be sure that middle class people are able to get on the property ladder and are able to build wealth. But when you think about it that way, does it really make sense to subsidize McMansions? Not really. You know, you want to target that a lot better than we're targeting it now. And I think that a lot of our welfare state really comes in that form, in that kind of invisible form where we say, oh, that's not welfare, but that's what it is. And so that's why we should apply stricter scrutiny to it.
So when you call for a conservative class consciousness among working class voters, again, that's going to sound to a lot of people like an oxymoron, conservative class consciousness. Doesn't conservatism reject the very idea of class consciousness as inherently Marxist?
Well, I think that class consciousness can mean a lot of different things in a lot of different contexts. I think that when you're looking at working class support for Republicans, a lot of it is based on the fact that, you know, they feel that conservatives are on the side, you know, on the side of working class folks in terms of family breakdown and issues like that. Because, you know, when you're looking at working class voters, they are at the sharpest end of a lot of this social and cultural change that you've seen happen in the country over the past several decades. So I think that in that regard, some consciousness that, you know, we actually benefit from strong families and that this is a political faction that is broadly on our side on this question, I think that makes sense. There are other kinds of class consciousness, however, that, you know, are hostile to mobility that we think of as very bad and, you know, very poisonous and that are cultivated by certain kinds of class warfare politics.
Well, so, but yeah, and the other point that I would make is that, you know, the working class, as we talk about it in the book, we're talking about non-college educated Americans. This is a huge percentage of the American population. This is, you know, especially Republicans have traditionally targeted the white working class, which is now probably 48% of the country. And we're a lot of what we're talking about is trying to start with that white working class base and broaden it out to include Latinos, blacks, and so on. I mean, that's a majority or even a supermajority of the American electorate. And so when we talk about class consciousness, it's in a very different sense, I think, than the traditional Marxist view of sort of, you know, a sort of narrow working class that's going to rise up and throw off its shackles. I mean, I think, you know, if you look back at what made the New Deal majority, the Roosevelt majority, so successful, it was this sense that people identified their class interest with the Democratic Party. And I think that, you know, that's something that any successful political majority has to do. It's not, you know, it's not Marxism. It's just how American politics works.
My guests on WNYC are Ross Douthat and Raihan Salam. They are authors of Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class. We can take some phone calls for them. Maybe this is not the first time you're hearing them. Certainly this book is getting some buzz in the political class right now in this election year. And if you want to talk about any of the ideas that they're discussing here or that you may have heard elsewhere, give us a call, 646-778-3729, 646-778-3729, or post to our comments page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Again, our phone number, 646-778-3729. You mentioned white working class consciousness having to do with family values. And I guess that's, well, that's one of the things that David Brooks said in his column that he likes about your book for what he calls the, he praised it for what he calls the interplay between values and economics. But that goes to the old-fashioned conservatism, I guess, right? Like, if only poor people would get married or stay married, most American poverty would be eliminated. So are you the next generation of social conservatives in this respect?
In some sense, yes. I mean, I think we're trying to start with that social conservative insight, and I think it's a true insight, which is that family breakdown has been one of the biggest drivers of inequality and social immobility in the United States over the past 25 years. If you look back to the 1950s and you look at marriage rates, divorce rates, out-of-wedlock birth rates across social classes, they were basically equal. Rich people were getting married and divorced and having kids out of wedlock at the same low rates as working-class people. Flash forward to today, The rich are still behaving like 1950s bourgeois, basically, like father knows best, except they're getting married a little later and having a couple fewer kids, maybe. But further down the income ladder, you have a lot more family breakdown, a lot of more out-of-wedlock births and so on. And that's a big that cultural component is a big driver of economic problems in the country. I think what we're trying to do, though, is start with that insight and say, well, look at the successful conservative reforms of the past. Look at things like welfare reform, which, you know, reduced teen pregnancy, reduced the incentives to out-of-wedlock child-rearing in inner-city communities. Are there other things we can do in that vein that will provide, you know, essentially sharpen the incentives for stable family formation? And that's why, you know, we focus on trying to make, you know, the tax code more family-friendly, trying to make health care more affordable for working families, basically trying to ease some of the economic burdens that are, you know, there's a cycle, right, where cultural breakdown creates economic burdens, which create further cultural breakdown and so on. And we're trying to intervene where the government can, where the government's already involved in the tax code and elsewhere, to break that cycle to some extent.
By the way, you know, that family breakdown actually does drive increases in the size of government over the long term.
Now, I didn't get to read the healthcare portion of your book very carefully, but I read a review that said that it's really pretty close to what the Democrats are proposing. Would you say that?
It's interesting because actually, no, our short-term vision is very close to what McCain is proposing, which is to say change the tax treatment, as Raihan said, for health care so that the government isn't essentially providing tax subsidies to upper middle class and wealthy people. I think we go a little further than McCain does then in terms of suggesting ways that the government can ease the transition to this more free market system by providing support for people facing catastrophic expenditures and people with pre-existing conditions who would have trouble getting treatment under a more free market approach. It's a case, basically, we're saying, you know, there are cases where to accomplish a conservative end, a more free market system, a more targeted system, you sometimes have to spend a little more money along the way. Now, it's true that we also have a longer-term vision where we're talking about the challenge posed in part by genetic testing and so on, which may make the traditional insurance model of healthcare out of date because everybody will sort of know what their odds of getting particular conditions are, and it'll be harder for insurance companies to cover people and so on. And in that model, we're proposing, again, I don't think the Democrats are proposing anything exactly like this, but it is a system where the government becomes the catastrophic insurer, basically. And then, Raihan, you can correct
me if I'm...
The Democrats
have the easier time right now because basically they recognize that Americans like roughly how the healthcare system works, and they're planning on plugging a few holes but not really addressing a lot of the long-term problems about cost. We are looking to those problems and looking to what are the problems that are going to emerge, you know, 10, 15 years from now. So I think that, you know, we've set ourselves a much tougher challenge in a way, and I think that we, you know, have some good ideas for meeting it.
So back to the question of whether John McCain is running on a vision similar to this. When we were at the Aspen Ideas Festival a few weeks ago, as I mentioned, I got to interview McCain's top economic advisor, Douglas Holtz-Aiken, and I asked him if Senator McCain shares your vision of government-enhanced social mobility and if he has a larger vision toward that end.
Certainly the senator has that vision, and as I said at the outset, he when he looks out at a crowd, he sees people who go to their jobs every day. And what he has talked about from the beginning of this campaign is the fact that there is a role for government. We have to have a government that's effective. And he sees this in education, where we are failing our obligation to our children. We have inner city schools where 50% of the kids don't graduate. Those that do aren't ready to go to college. That is a route to social failure, quite frankly.
And what's the means to that? Does he believe in No Child Left Behind as it exists?
No. He supports some of the things that came with No Child Left Behind. The transparency and accountability are important. Some standard setting is often useful. But the money in No Child Left Behind was meant to go to lower-income kids, and it was meant to go to them to enhance their learning. Too much of that money is not going to that, and part of it is the details of the design. He'd reform that.
McCain's top economics advisor, Douglas Holtz-Aiken, and we got off on No Child Left Behind there, but how much would you guys say that McCain is running on economic ideas consistent with yours?
I think that John McCain recognizes that this election is about Barack Obama, and he also recognizes that he's going to have a very hard time advancing his own distinctive domestic policy agenda. So I think that's why he's really focused on foreign policy. But that's why it really is incumbent upon conservatives who are outside of the campaign apparatus to start thinking about domestic policy, because Republicans are too often trying to change the subject from areas that Americans care about, American voters, they care about healthcare, education, and jobs, to areas where they feel comfortable talking about national security and terrorism. So I think that John McCain is trying to draw on a lot of different ideas. You mentioned Phil Gramm, and I think that, you know, he has, you know, that tendency, and that he's also trying to look to ways in which he can draw on, you know, some of these family-friendly ideas as well. But changing the Republican Party, changing conservative movement so that it's more in line with working-class families and their interests and their aspirations is a process that's going to take a very, very long time. It's probably going to take a decade or more. So I think it's going to be, you know, it's hard to see how he's going to be able to pull that off in the space of a few months, because he has his back against the wall in a very tough political environment.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to, you know, since Douglas Holtzik and said such kind things about our book, I don't want to say anything unkind about the McCain campaign. But there is a sense in which I think the broad narrative that McCain has tried to sketch out of government reform of himself as a reformer who's sort of on the side of the middle class rather than the special interest, that's exactly the kind of narrative we're talking about in the book. I think that the McCain campaign could go a lot further in a lot of respects in terms of sort of fleshing out details and sort of, you know, I think this happens in every presidential campaign, but there's a tendency to sort of speak in generalities, and I think the Republican Party in particular, as Reihan says, has sort of been losing the struggle on over domestic policy detail recently. There aren't that many detailed Republican proposals on domestic policy, so that's the void we're trying to fill.
Yeah, and David Brooks, in his column on your book, and Reihan used to work for him, says the McCain economic plan so far looks like an omnibus spending bill with no larger social vision.
Yeah, no, but to go to Reihan's point, I think that, McCain knows that even if he wins this election, he's going to face Democratic majorities in both houses of Congress. There isn't going to be a McCain agenda in the way there would be a Barack Obama agenda if he wins. So in a sense, I can understand why, you know, their economic agenda is essentially, you know, they haven't tried to either craft a larger narrative or make it all add up exactly. But that being said, narratives are pretty helpful for winning presidential campaigns, even if you aren't going to govern on them.
Well, Stefan and Reihan Salaam with me on WNYC, authors of Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. And Evan in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Evan.
Yes. My question is, how does this enlightened conservatism propose to pay off the enormous debt we have incurred with things like the Iraqian war without tremendous inflation? How can it be done without inflation?
All right. Who wants it?
I think that's an excellent question, and I think the truth is that we are in a very constrained environment right now, and if you're going to have, you know, really big changes to the way our welfare state works, you're going to have to look at big sources of money that are invisible, namely looking at tax subsidies. I think that, you know, our tax code right now is basically been used by both political parties in order to buy discrete constituencies rather than to do what conservatives ought to do, which is create a system that will have the lowest taxes over the longest period of time. Sometimes that means that you're going to have slightly higher taxes at one time than another because of, you know, the demographic picture. But it means that we need a much more coherent approach to the revenue side. And then on the spending side, I think it means that you have to look very hard at whether or not the federal government should be involved in, for example, a lot of the education spending, the K-12 education spending we've been involved in. That's a small piece of it, but also looking at, you know, means testing and reframing Social Security. Social Security is a system where you have incredibly regressive high payroll taxes that make it very hard to create jobs and also are a punishing burden on working class people, but at the same time, you know, gives benefits to a lot of people who can fend for themselves. So I think that, you know, you really need to take a hard look at a lot of programs in order to, you know, think more intelligently about their impact.
I mean, I think if you look, you know, what we're talking about in the book, you know, doesn't always go to the questions of the broader fiscal picture, precisely because we're trying to come up with some discrete domestic policy ideas that, you know, the Republican Party lacks. But I think Ryan's broader point about, you know, if you can move to a welfare state that's geared towards the people who need it most rather than being, you know, geared towards both corporate welfare and welfare for the upper middle class, you can save an enormous amount of money. This is obviously politically very challenging to do. Means testing Social Security, means testing Medicare, you know, these are incredibly fraught political issues. But I think that if, you know, I think, oddly, the Republican Party is actually positioned very well, precisely because it's become a more working-class party, to frame this kind of necessary fiscal adjustment in terms of making the welfare state more fair to working-class voters.
One last thing, and I'll call it sort of the Thomas Frank question from a listener on our webpage, Thomas Frank, who wrote, "What's the matter with Kansas?" And the listener kind of asked the same question, which is, what is happening, he or she writes, is that the white guy who the GOP could count on, the Archie Bunkers of this world, who was conned by the GOP into thinking that most Democratic policies would help minorities, women, and immigrants at his expense, is now waking up and realizing that it was the GOP policies that are real detriment to him. What he has seen is crony capitalism by the GOP. What do you say to that, especially as you continue to make the socially conservative arguments as the means to economic growth?
Well, look, we're critics of the Bush-era Republican Party, and we think that there is, you know, there is an extent to the liberal critique, especially the idea that, you know, the GOP as a pro-market party tends to get too cozy with big business, too involved in subsidies for corporate interests. There's an element of that critique that's true. But I think if you look back over the past 30 years, a lot of our book is essentially an argument with the Thomas Frank thesis. We're saying, no, if you look at actual GOP policies over the past 30 years from, you know, basically the attempt to break the stagflation trap in the 1970s and get the economy growing again to narrower issues like welfare reform, like crime, where, frankly, Republican policies made an enormous difference in lowering the crime rate, actually the GOP has done a lot for the working class. And the idea that issues like, for instance, crime are just symbolic issues that you know, don't matter as much as economic issues, that's just silly. The biggest social problem in the United States over the past 30 years was the enormous rise in the crime rate from the 60s to the 1990s. And people were right to vote on that issue. Working class voters were right to vote on that issue. And Republicans were right to propose tougher on crime measures that ultimately helped reduce the crime rate. So I think there's a lot for Republicans to apologize for in the past 4 to 8 years. I'm less convinced that there's an enormous amount Republicans have to apologize over the broad sweep of the Republican majority.
Ross Douthat and Raihan Salam have written Grand New Party, How Republicans Can Win the Working Class and Save the American Dream. Thanks so much for coming on with us.
Thanks a lot, Brian. Thanks so much, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, are we overusing the word narcissism? Stay with us.